Bandwidth for MacBreak Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
You're listening to MacBreak Tech, emulating just about anything. We now join a conversation already in progress.
You got to tell this story about baseball again.
So, in terms of machines that have software that was dependent on a specific type of hardware, Mike, we used to play this baseball game called Hardball. I think that was the name of it, Hardball.
Yeah, wasn't it from Activision or something like
that? It was something like that, yeah. And I think I played it on some Commodore 64, but my cousin had an Apple IIgs, and he had it as well. And there was something about the software that had been coded for one of the older machines with a slower processor or something. And so instead of accounting for that, the game just ran faster. So it was like playing baseball at 100 miles an hour. The pitches were screaming past you, and the swing was just a blur. But it was definitely not accounting for a new generation of hardware.
Those old machines were so dependent on clock speed. I mean, the guy was making a game specifically to do he was taking it every single CPU cycle to make it do something. It got tuned to that speed. And sometimes things were slow on purpose. They were just...
Right.
Hardball actually was from Accolade.
Oh, was it Accolade? Well, okay. Oh, Accolade. I forgot
about
that.
So I did get the AC part of the name right.
Yeah. And it was ported to... I just had to look it up. It was ported to, like, everything. Everything from a PlayStation all the way to the Apple II.
Oh, yeah. It was a hugely popular game.
Is there a DOS version?
Yes, there was.
Neato. So you could probably... This is the coolest thing. Because that game is so old, you could download Hardball to your Mac or your Intel Mac and then run this program called DOSBox.
What does DOSBox do?
DOSBox is a DOS emulator. So it basically takes a machine like an IBM PC, the normal 640K of RAM.
Right. Your generic x86.
VGA graphics and the whole thing. And you can load the directory using a thing called Mount C, which says mounted as the C drive, and then the name of the directory. And then you can then go C colon and then type, baseball or hardball, and then it'll play that game.
Fun.
And the cool thing about this DOSBox is that it allows things to run that are old, that are dependent on that hardware, those timings and those speeds and that kind of stuff. It's a free program. So the world's working on it. They said, here, it's open source. We want everybody to be able to have this kind of experience. And there's thousands of things that you can run using this software.
Their tagline is way more FPS, frames per second, than Counter-Strike. Which is funny, because that is always the thing with games. Everyone's always wanting to benchmark their system and see with these games that are pushing your hardware, what... With everything turned up, how many frames per second am I getting? And these old games, of course, with no requirements by modern standards, run fantastic on your emulation.
Well, and the cool thing is that you can actually limit the frame rate. You can say, I need this to run at this speed so that it will be running at normal speed.
Well, and they've got a great list of all the old classic video games that are supported under DOSBox. That's awesome.
Day of the Tentacle. Sam and Max. And I was playing with Zork.
Zork.
Okay, so no.
Oh, yes.
And so there are modern game engines that take the Zork files, the DAT file that has all the commands in it.
Sure.
And it will actually play that. So you can run it native in OS X.
Fun.
But it's way cooler to play it like the original code.
Through an emulated system.
Yeah. And so you can get the images for Zork and Cutthroat and all the other things. They're all out there somewhere.
And all the versions of Zork even, right?
Yeah, Zork 1, 2, 3 and Zork Beyond, all of that stuff is there.
Right.
So, you can say you can go into the dungeon without your torch on and it says you're likely to be eaten by a Gru.
It is amazing how many games were out there. You just look at these lists. MAME is the same way, too. The Nether Emulator, yeah. I'm sure we'll talk about. But just the sheer quantity of games that were created for these platforms back in the day. And mm-hmm. everyone has some game that was their sort of nostalgia game from yeah. childhood or what have you that that you would love to just boot up one more time and see if you're still very bad at, in my case.
Well, exactly.
yeah. You go, like, still suck at Karateka. That's for sure.
Karateka.
Oh, never saved I remembered that.
You never saved the princess?
No, I think I finally did, but it was as a much, much older man.
The thing was with the prince, so you never knew this. The thing was with the princess is that if you walked in fighter mode, she kicked your ass.
you had to approach her peacefully.
You had to approach her peacefully.
She's a very modern woman.
No, you approached her and you came up to her and she kicked you in the head and you broke your neck.
Oh.
Yep. I forgot about that.
It was like, oh, you bastards. It was the game guys having a bit of a laugh at our expense.
Yeah, because it was something to get to her. So yeah. to make that mistake at the end and have to go through it again, not so sweet.
Yeah.
Now you could technically, these DOS boxes are meant to be generic in that you could run any software. It just tends to be games are the reason that folks are seeking yeah. out some of these emulators.
Well, so one of the things that I found was that Dan Bricklin released the 27K of code for VisiCalc.
Mm.
So
27K.
So you can open classic VisiCalc. And this was a program that cost, I think it was $500 at the time. And it runs just like VisiCalc.
And it's sort of considered to be one of the first killer apps for home computing, right?
It was the reason
to buy a home computer.
It was the thing
the thing that you could get you the budget, get the approval to buy the home computer.
It wasn't just, but all businesses said, this is saving us a significant time. And so we're going to standardize our workflow on this concept. Mm-hmm. Of a spreadsheet, although it did introduce all kinds of crazy errors into the workforce,
rounding errors,
people that used the sum command incorrectly.
Ouch!
You know, leaving something off, that kind of thing. But anyway, if you want to be nostalgic, you can download Zork and you can download VisiCalc and you can double click and see all that stuff play.
Those are the people I want to hear from. I want to hear from the people who for whom VisiCalc is their nostalgia app of choice.
Yeah. I love running VisiCalc. It's my main accounting software I use still.
I remember we had a copy when my parents ran it at home.
Right. So as far as modern emulation.
As far as modern emulation. Oh, my gosh. Who knew that this was going to be the big thing that really changed computing?
Billion-dollar companies.
Billion-dollar. I mean, VMware is massive.
Yeah.
I didn't know how big VMware was until I started researching what mm-hmm. this. It's monster size.
And the bulk of it is for the enterprise infrastructure folks, your data centers that are running. I mean, the idea is that you can run virtualized instances of the computer on, or a computer on an operating system on a single set of hardware. So you could have, if you had enough power at your disposal, you could slice it so you're running 10 instances of some Windows server and another 10 Linux servers. And
right. Yeah. Well, and this is huge in and of itself, because when you consider the amount of malware, spyware, and viruses that are constantly attacking servers, you really can't just have the stuff run on the metal anymore. Because if it gets broken, then the person has access to the metal. Thing is that if somebody breaks into a virtual machine, they're broke into the virtual machine, that instance can die instantly and be replaced with a backup within seconds.
Right.
Right.
The tools for intrusion detection still have to be there to know that you've been owned
in
the first place. But yeah, taking care of it is as easy as rolling back to a snapshot, hopefully. Yeah.
Although, you got to be careful, though, because, for example, if you're using, let's say, Parallels, and you let Parallels share to your Macintosh partition, then you're basically opening up all your Macintosh, your directory structure, which is kind of the default of the latest version of Parallels. You've opened up your entire home directory to any virus or any intrusion that happens to Windows. And a lot of people don't realize that when they install things like Parallels and Fusion.
Well, that's why you should all, if you're sharing a folder I mean, if you're going to share something, you should only share to one folder.
Right, right. A share folder that lets you transfer files between your Mac and your PC or your Linux or whatever system you set up.
You basically pretend that you're still using a machine somewhere else on your network. So you drag a file into there, and then that's where that file lives. Instead of saying, oh, I'm going to be lazy and open up my whole directory.
Yeah. I'm just going to open myself up to all these attacks.
Don't do that.
It's interesting, too, that from an energy perspective, you're seeing one of the reasons people are touting virtualization now is just to have less hardware. For a long time, it was the whole scale-out thing was the answer to needing more instances or spreading out services across multiple hardware for redundancy. And there's still a ton of that going on, but now there's this interesting counter-trend of bigger iron boxes that are running a bunch of virtual instances, but from a physical standpoint, don't take up as much resources in terms of space and power.
So in the research that I was doing today, I went to a bunch of places that have reviewed all these tools. So VMware, Parallels, Crossover, all that stuff. And the reviews are wildly out of date.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, for example, the Macworld...
I totally agree with that.
The Macworld magazine review that was released a year ago in 2007... talks about how USB doesn't work, talks about how DirectX doesn't work that well.
Interesting.
Talks about how all these things that, you know, this doesn't work, this doesn't a lot of that has been fixed.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you can run high-end 3D applications under emulation now with hardly any issues that I know of.
Right.
Well, and I was helping a friend of mine actually do some testing, and I've done testing myself because I needed to have a full copy of Windows when I went on the road for some of the work I'm doing. And, you know, both VMware and Parallels and Crossover, I should say, also run great, especially the latest version of Parallels is what I finally settled on. I mean, I'm running 3D apps in there as if I was just running on my old PC. In fact, they run better on my Mac through Parallels than they are on my PC at home.
Wow. So there's a performance article, an article that talks about the virtualization benchmarks and how all these things stack up at Mac Tech Magazine. And the guy went and he said, here's real world examples. Here's benchmark tools that we know. Here's this. Mm-hmm. And found that the tools were pretty much, you know, there's some advantages to VMware. There's some advantages to Parallels. There's some advantages to Crossover. It just depends on what kind of thing you're running. So I don't think at this point there is a clear, you know, based on this article, there's not a clear winner,
right?
It really comes down to how much you want to pay, and what specific feature you absolutely have to have support for.
I was just going
to
say, for most folks, the sort of basics are covered with either or any of those out of the box, right? You can talk to your other – it maps your other partitions. So if you're running multiple OSs, you can get back to your main sort of partition the host OS is running. All the network stuff is sort of handled transparently now so that you're instantly on. You're not having to do a bunch of weird bridging configuration yourself.
Right.
And then the 3D stuff, the fact that the graphics engines are there, or the ability to utilize DirectX and all the stuff that some of the graphics engines use or graphics applications.
I was actually surprised at how much stuff Crossover supports from a game platform point of view.
You know, what sort of features?
Just the sheer number of games that they've tuned,
certified to work.
Yeah, that they've said, here's, we know about this game, we can make a bottle for it.
Interesting.
And it'll run very, very well.
And Crossover is the one where you end up with instances of applications that are meant to just
so
run.
Out of all of these, they all, VMware Parallels and this other one called VirtualBox, all of those need to have a real copy of the OS in order for it to run. Crossover is the one that basically says you just need to have the app, right? And so all of the things that you would want to be able to run, like, for example, Word, PowerPoint, the Visio.
Oh, right.
You know, the beloved Power,
Project
the maker.
Management.
Right.
What is that? Oh, it's a Mac Draw. You know, big, expensive Mac Draw.
Sure.
Or OmniGraph.
Right, or OmniGraph. But with VMware Parallels and VirtualBox, you have to have, so you can't just, in the case of Windows, because of the way that the authentication works. It has to be the real deal.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just serial number to working.
Right.
It doesn't work that way.
Right.
You could do the install, let it run for 30 days, and then blow it up, and then open up another instance and let it run for 30 days.
Yeah, I guess.
There's nothing wrong with that unless you're, needing to do real work with it.
Right.
So there's a cost involved, and I think about the cheapest that you can buy a copy of Windows XP is about $130.
Sounds about right.
And that's a OEM version. And the thing, oh my, did you read about this? Mm. June 30th is the day that there's going to be no more XP.
Oh, they're doing it?
Yeah, they're cutting it off. They're not going to manufacture anymore.
Interesting.
Which is like,
no more XP.
Yeah, and you can, what you can do is you can buy a copy of Vista and then do the back rev to say, okay, well, I'm going to, why wouldn't you just be able to buy XP to begin with?
No, they definitely want to. They'll do that. You want to phase it out eventually. I mean, despite the sort of lackluster acceptance of it,
sure.
Eventually it's just going to take over just sheer numbers. Just sheer numbers, machines.
Right. I think, well, I don't know. I've watched people who are very familiar with XP mm-hmm. struggle with Vista.
Oh, yeah, I'm still running XP. Mm-hmm. I'm on my other partition. I'm running XP as opposed to Vista. I haven't moved up yet.
I have a friend who's a beta tester of Vista, had a killer laptop supposedly designed for Vista and all that. At the end of the beta, he got a full new free copy, the full released version. He was like, no thanks, I'm switching to a Mac.
Wow. That's funny.
When he told me that, I was like, okay.
All right, yeah. So we've talked about how this is being used for running basically Windows applications, but there's mm-hmm. other stuff that you can run. For example, Linux works, Solaris works. If you want, you can run DOS in the emulator, not just DOSBox, but you could run a specific version of DOS.
Mm-hmm. I want to run the BOS.
What's that? BOS?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, you could run BOS in the.
Yeah, you can.
Yeah, how fun? How cool is that? The last version of BOS was actually a pretty cool OS.
It was like ahead of the curve for multimedia stuff for a long time.
Well, and the way that it supported dual processors was kind of ahead of the game, and then it was full POSIX compatible, so you could actually run whatever command line Unixy stuff that was there. So if you're nostalgic about that, definitely pull down an image of that and run it.
From a development and testing standpoint, this stuff has always been huge in that. As you move up versions of the operating system, especially Windows, you always invariably have some client that is still using your product on a previous version. And if you don't have this, I remember using VMware to test Windows 95 and 98 boxes for this product that had very slow acceptance. It was an academic environment, a research environment where they just didn't upgrade their OSs. When something was working, it was attached to some machine that was running a test and they never upgraded. And you boot into your VMware and you can see in that instance how your thing is running without having to have a box sitting around.
Right. So, yeah, there's no way that – well, the hardware from Windows 95 would be 12 years old at this point.
Mm-hmm. They finally, 5-6 years ago, they were finally cutting off the Windows 95 folks. Mm-hmm. And they're about to do so for the Windows 98. And then from a server standpoint, the ability to test stuff, test configuration changes, do whatever you want that way, and know that if you make a mistake, you're just rebooting from your previous save of the instance. That's a huge boon for folks who are doing that sort of work as well.
Well, and you do a lot of that development work that way, don't you, Ben? I mean, you basically have a full test environment you run that way, right?
Yeah, my dev server is essentially a Parallels instance of Linux that's running on my box. So I publish to that, and if it's working good, then you go to whatever sort of staging server and then eventually to live. But yeah, it's great because you can essentially work offline too. In the rare instances that you're off network, you're still on in the sense that your local in-machine network is still there for you to access. It's great. For folks who are interested in learning about Linux, you can download, or Unix stuff in general, you can download these fully installed versions. You don't have to go through all the installation hassle. You just download it and run it. It's a great way to sort of play around without having to have a box around or do the installation yourself, which is usually the big hurdle for folks.
If you want to, Tiny Linux is a good example, right? it's basically runs on 2 meg of it's the smallest thing possible.
It's amazing how small some of these distributions can get.
Yeah.
But if you've ever wanted to check stuff out, instead of saying, okay, well, here's the physical PC that I'm going to install this on,
right,
and then have to deal with, you know, repartitioning the disk and blasting it, and oh, I didn't want to do that, you just make the DMG and load it up and you're done.
Right.
Right.
Works really well.
Well, and I think that's one of the things also. I mean, you know, one of the things I get asked also about is boot camp. You know, boot camp came out when the new Intel Macs came out, and it was like, oh, wow, I can run Windows on my Intel Mac. And I was one of those people who jumped on the bandwagon, and it was great. But I had to take up 32 gigs of hard drive space to do it, and I had to reboot my Mac to get in there. 32 gigs of hard drive space.
That's so, mostly empty.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was one of the big things about my home system when I set up on my Mac Pro. I set up boot camp, but then suddenly I had to like give up this huge chunk of hard drive space because that was the minimum amount that they allowed you to actually give over to the installation for boot camp. And that's actually why I've really liked the virtualization engines, because now you have, in essence, this dynamic disk that's, in a sense, stealing space from your internal drive. So it's easy for you to run the virtualizations on a laptop and actually have multiple operating systems on the go.
I like the fact that I can copy that image off to somewhere else,
right,
and then delete it. And then if I need it again, I can load it back on.
Yeah, a single file becomes your backup of an entire system, which is kind of nice. Yeah. They're big, depending on how much data you got in there, but couldn't be easier for backup perspective.
Well, in the today of terabyte hard drives, that little tiny 32 gig partition is not that big of a deal to move that.
Right.
From a hard drive point of view, on my laptop, on my MacBook Pro, that is a big deal because that thing is always jammed full of projects anyway.
But and even podcasts and all that. I mean, if you do a base install, because I just did this for my system, you know, getting ready to do a bunch of travel, I wanted to go in and get the most minimal install I could. So I rebuilt my Parallels disk with just the bare minimum install, all the patches on the OS, and 3 main apps. That's all I needed under Windows. I installed that, and the entire disk image for everything was basically about 4 gigs.
Wow.
And that was it. And it was perfect. It's like, oh, I can easily give 4 gigs off my internal hard drive to that. So,
you know, the thing that I'm most amazed about is installing this stuff.
Mm.
Oh, yeah.
Like, just how quickly everything installs.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if you've – and we've all experienced reloading XP onto a machine, it can take a couple of hours sometimes, especially
– It's an older machine.
You know, it depends on the machine. I think the very fastest that I've ever done it was about half an hour on pretty newish hardware.
Right.
But it used to grind and grind and grind, and it was like, oh, my gosh, can this be any – on Parallels and on VMware, they have both installers – that are doing this rapid install, and I swear it takes 10 minutes for it to build that image.
Right. That was the one of the reasons behind the from the consumer perspective anyway, the relatively slow adoption of this stuff is that there is a performance penalty. The machines are just getting fast enough now that we're not seeing it as much.
Right.
One of the few edge cases where I would really need to boot into boot camp to give the Windows the entire resources of the machine to work with, as opposed to some whatever slice I'm giving the Parallels or VMware instance, is if you want something that's super CPU and or memory intensive to take up the whole machine to go as fast as it can.
Right.
But other than those rare occasions, there's no reason to even boot in anymore.
I can't even – in my life, I can't even imagine needing to give something that much all the power.
Right. I'm thinking of something like if you're running a simulation in XSI, one of those things that if you're using a high-end graphics application, you might want to, if it's going to be a long render anyway, you might want to just boot in as opposed to running that under Parallels to give it more RAM and CPU at its disposal. But again,
if you're going to be running that, you're going to be running on like a Mac Pro. So if you have like one of the new Mac Pro 8 core systems,
right,
you can in essence still give over, you know, oh, I'm going to give Parallels, you know, I'm going to give it 6 of the cores.
Right. Yeah, I'm thinking from the perspective of a laptop when you've only got 2 gigs or whatever. Yep. But right, if you're on a beefy machine like the one you're talking about, then even that goes out the window.
Well, multiple cores really changes all this, doesn't it?
Yeah. Oh, totally. Because suddenly I can literally have two OSs running simultaneously, and you know, some of the cores are given to the one OS and some of the cores are given to another OS. I mean, on a nice 8-proc system, or an 8-core system, I should say, it almost becomes irrelevant in some ways.
The funny thing is that the one OS that is missing from this landscape of OSs you can run virtually is ours, macOS.
Well, they're talking about having this work.
Are they?
The Parallels guys and the VMware guys both were demonstrating things at Macworld.
Oh, okay. I missed that.
For example, OS X server, for example.
Mm-hmm. That's where I could see you'd want to run a bunch of instances, yeah.
Yeah.
And there have been companies in the past, and I don't, the name is totally escaping me suddenly, that basically let you run the Mac OS on non-Mac hardware.
Mm.
So they've come and gone and, you know, more or less disappeared, I think, into the vapor.
Yeah.
But there have been companies that have done it, and I remember seeing demos at Macworld in the past about that.
Maybe just ahead of their time. On the one hand, it's not necessarily in Apple's interest, because that's always been the hardware as dongle thing, right? Mm-hmm. The only place you can run this is on our hardware, which is fine, because that's, you know, it's in their interest to do it that way. But
right.
It would be nice, especially from the server perspective, like John's mentioning. I would love to have a reasonably decked out Mac Pro running 5 or 6 instances of server that are running different
configurations
on the network.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Or for testing. Yeah.
Or for testing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Well, you know, we may see this in a future iteration of OS X. I mean, there's no reason why a third party should be responsible for making that work.
Right.
I mean, that's basically saying, here's a lot. We're going to give this control to this company. And then suddenly Apple's kind of taken out of the picture, and then it's just thing in a bottle, just like everything else.
Yeah, even if it's just on the server side, it seems like it's to their benefit to have some sort of virtualization.
There's not a lot, from a user point of view, there's not a lot of reason to run
for desktop. Yeah, I can't.
The only reason why you'd want to do it is if you're on the other side. So you're running Vista as your primary, and you want to emulate Mac OS X.
Sure. Which Apple doesn't want you to do.
No, they don't want you to do that.
I guess testing, too, the same sort of thing. Like, if you wanted to install a bunch of stuff and play around with a bunch of configuration changes and not know that you're not screwing up your home machine, like, you want to try out a bunch of things, then you don't want to deal with whatever they might be leaving on the system.
Goes to the same thing we talked about where you can, this has gone wrong, blast the partition.
Just roll back.
Load up the new one, you know, Command D for duplicate,
mm-hmm.
you know, Command Delete for delete, mm-hmm. but then make that work like that. So, yeah, I think, you know, from a testing point of view, sure, you know, having tested much software, I can see how that would work. But from the guy doing his work point of view, there's no reason for that.
Now, the one thing that I have run into, and this has been an issue on a project I'm working on, is that when you test under a system like Parallels or, you know, Crossover or Fusion, you're testing with the Mac hardware. And there are some cases where, you know, a dedicated like HP or Dell or some other, you know, dedicated Windows hardware manufacturer, it's actually still going to run different. So OS...
Right, because you've got driver issues, you've got hardware issues, Realtek versus Broadcom for your mm-hmm. network controller, you know, all those things.
Does that end up
being an NVIDIA graphics card that doesn't work with a Mac?
Yeah, does it end up being graphics, like rendering errors? Is that what you're running mm-hmm. into?
Yeah, that's actually one of the big ones, is that typically the gamma values of Windows machines are different than the gamma values of the Mac. Now, I've noticed that when you run under Parallels or things like that, they're kind of handling some of that for you. You don't see those same gamma issues that you see when you run on a dedicated piece of hardware PC, or a PC hardware, I should say.
Hmm. Well, there is that.
And there are other rendering issues. But, you know, beyond that, a lot of things, you know, as far as usability and testing, I've had great success using Parallels and VMware.
You will always have the hardware being the issue. And that's why we have to test on multiple machines. Mm-hmm. You know, just because it looks correct on your machine doesn't mean that it looks correct on the Dell or the HP or the other or the other Mac.
Yep.
You have to always look. Well, we have, you know, the idea that virtualization makes us gets us out of that trap of having to have the other computer there, compatibility checking there. There's always the game issue. We had one of the people write in about, he was from a Mac Gamer. And I'm going to get that wrong. What's the other one? It's the site that's black and orange. Type in Mac Gamer right now. That's not the right one. Inside Mac Games. That's it.
Oh, okay.
So the tester for the editor for Inside Mac Games wrote about the Myth Show, where we were talking about how there are actually, in fact, lots of games for the Mac.
Mm.
He was like, no, there really aren't.
Is he talking about the high-end games?
The high-end commercial games that everybody wants to take part of.
Mm-hmm.
And so where was this going? Oh, right. Well, the idea of games is that the emulators actually open up the possibilities of playing lots of these new games.
Sure.
Right. Right. Although that is one area where, I will say, I did testing of a lot of 3D stuff in the early version of most of the virtualizations, and it wasn't very good. It's not till this last crop or last versions, like Parallels 3 and the latest version of Fusion, that you really are starting to see the 3D emulation really get to a point where it's really truly usable for both 3D graphics applications and for hardcore gaming.
Well, they had, there was so much work to do to get just the VM machine to work, the virtual machine to work, that, you know, go for the hard problems first. Go for the things that are going to be the most troublesome, like USB and the DVD and the networking, for example. Mm-hmm. Get the screen to sort of work. You know, make it work as if it's a VGA emulator. Yeah. Get that in its place and make it go. And then over the next bunch of time, start adding all those other features. And I think, you know, like, we're going to continue to see this thing get revved at a rapid rate. It's just going to get better and better. And there was a quote on the internet, and I couldn't find it, but the guy said, if you have to run Windows, this is the way to run it.
It is
an absolutely great experience. And now that you've got spaces in place, spaces change. It really changes. You know, instead of having the window there, you can assign it to the space. It's the full screen. I'm like, oh, I got to switch the Windows machine. Mm-hmm. Command arrow or, you know, control arrow, and you're there.
I did that in front of this guy the other day, and he was like, wait, what'd you just do? Wait, you were running Windows, now you're in the Mac OS? I don't understand.
I'm running Windows in a bottle.
Yeah, so it's definitely a unique experience doing that.
Let's talk about the other fun emulator that you can run, which is MAME.
MAME.
Have you dedicated hardware to MAME?
Dedicated hardware to MAME?
Yeah.
I mean, like, that's the only thing it does. MAME box.
Yeah.
One of our old companies, we had a MAME box, and that was it. Just had you download whatever images you wanted to play, and that was it.
Actually, I think I did take one of my old Macs for a while, and it was pretty much a MAME emulator. I haven't used it in a while, though, now I think about it.
A friend of mine made a box. I mean, it was his MAME project. He spent 6 months.
Did he put it in a sweet arcade chassis and the whole bit?
Well, he went and bought the arcade specific box.
Oh, wow.
So that he could have a monitor, a specific piece of glass. And he bought the controller for the display so that the VGA card would then do all the different timings.
Oh, okay.
Oh, you're kidding.
So that Tempest, for example, would look correct.
This is for folks who don't know the acronym, it's Multiple Arcade Machine Emulator. And it's this sort of generic emulator that will run almost all. I mean, over time, they've built a huge library.
It runs 6502 code, Z80 code, 6809 code, Amtel code.
All the stuff that was running your old arcade machines.
8088 code. 8086 code. I mean, it just runs absolutely crazy stuff. Mm-hmm. This thing showed up out of, let's see, I think it was one of the very first PowerPC things, because PowerPCs, when they first came out, were really good at emulating stuff. So the very first emulator that was on the PowerPC was the 68K emulator.
Okay.
And so all this code could continue to run. And so when these guys saw this, they're like, that's cool. And so there were literally 800 emulators at some point for PowerPC, everything from Nintendo,
Super NES.
There was a Sega Genesis emulator, and all this stuff was there, and it was fun to be able to play these games. But the problem was the controller. If you didn't have the right kind of controller, then Sonic the Hedgehog wasn't quite controllable.
Well, what's funny is if you actually go to the MAME site, you can actually look at their development history and the number of supported ROM sets and unique games. And as of somewhere in 2007, it was 6,465 unique ROMs and 3,482 unique games.
Wow. That's a lot of games.
Yeah.
I don't think I've played that many.
I don't think I've put quarters in that many machines.
That's one of the funny things about MAME is because it's just running the old software, there's always a button for you to add quarters. You still have to add quarters. It's just a lot cheaper than it was when you did it at the roller rink or whatever.
I think it's one and two.
Right.
You put a quarter in for one or two. Yeah, because the game is looking for the input from the quarter lever. Yeah. So you actually have to trip that in order for it to work. That's
so funny.
And it's been around. The project has been around for 10 years now. They started in 97.
They've
just celebrated their 10th anniversary. Wow. It's cool. If you remember playing some game back in the day, as they say, and you haven't seen it since, then check out MAME. It's a fun experiment to just take a trip down gaming memory lane anyway.
The thing is that it's not just it's running the real code.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's the image of the ROM. And they've had to set up the video timings so that it was, like, for example, Robotron was made in 32K.
Mm.
And 16K of it was, then it had two buffers. So they would flip the screen.
Uh-huh.
So they would draw on one 8K and they would draw on the other 8K. And then the game ran in 16K.
Wow.
And so, it was every time it updated, it would flip the buffer. And so it was like, there you're seeing this game doing this. They have to make that work. It has to be supported in software to make that hardware do that. Pretty cool stuff. So, you know, you think, oh, yeah, that's Pac-Man. It's not really – no, it really is Pac-Man. And and they've been faithful to get the real sounds to work. In some cases, the sound cannot be emulated emulating the software and hardware, because it was a hardware thing that was doing.
Oh, like a special chip, dedicated
chip. So sometimes they've had to record the sounds out of it and then just use that as the cue for
you
where.
Do it as a sample based thing.
Yeah, they do it as a sample based thing. But that doesn't change the gameplay in any way.
Yep. Oh, how fun that is.
Yeah. And then there's another emulator called Scum, which basically lets you play all the.
Is it the LucasArts games?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They had that Scum. That was their acronym for their story system on those graphical adventure games.
So somebody wrote and continues to maintain an emulator that plays all the Scum files.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. So if you don't want to run the original game in DOSBox, you can actually get the files and play them in the...
So the whole game was encapsulated in the Scum file?
Yeah.
So you could play the Monkey Island games or the Day of the Tentacle stuff and all of that?
It was all – so basically they just had a player that played these files back. And in the Scum file, it had the graphics. It had the animated moving guy was and all the things.
All the logic was in that.
And then there was just an architecture that played it back.
Interesting. Those are some classic games.
The thing of it is that the kids have not – the kids today, you know, like the people who are just discovering games, you know, they owe it to themselves to go back and play these games. Because the storytelling on Day of the Tentacle and Monkey Island, incredible.
Yeah.
And then when you look at the graphics on this stuff, it's beautiful. I mean, yeah, it's 8-bit.
Very painterly, though.
Very painterly, but it's 8-bit, but it's gorgeous. Whoever the artist was on that was just knew what they... knew what that medium was going to do and how they could pull that stuff out.
Well, and how you can eke great graphics out of 8 bits of visual information, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. So.
Well, and I will say that I've met some young hardcore gamers who totally know about the MAME scene, mainly because they are so into games. They're like, "Well, where did this come from?" And I was really surprised because I was helping teach a class on video games a couple years ago, and every kid in that class knew about MAME and they knew about emulation and that they were going back and playing those old classic games. So I was really surprised that the really hardcore gamers, even the young ones today, really do get into the scene and kind of find out, you know, hey, where did this come from?
Exactly. So. Or they just get bored of their things and they're like, I want another game. And someone goes, hey, well, have you ever played Pac-Man? Have you ever played Joust? Have you ever played Robotron?
From a game development standpoint or design standpoint, it's really interesting to see these older games where they didn't have all of this hardware to throw at creating the worlds, and the gameplay had to be where all of the innovation was taking place because the eye candy was not there. And it's amazing with those constraints, the variety of gameplay that they were able to come up with.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of my favorite old ones was Grid Runner.
Which one?
Grid Runner, I think it was. Wasn't that it?
I don't remember Grid Runner. It was not Load Runner.
No. This is really old. I thought it was Grid Runner. It was an old Commodore 64 game. I just remember. I'm pretty sure it was Grid Runner. But anyways,
well, you can look it up and tell us later. Which one?
One of the things.
Yeah, there's one called Grid Runner. What was it like?
It was literally a set of lines and kind of in a 3D perspective, and you went along the lines and you had to avoid bad guys or enemy ships, I think it was. Ah, it's been such a long time.
They make it
now.
Sound like it's a capture the flag game?
Oh, that was the,
or is that
that
something
was the
newer?
One that came out for the PlayStation, I think.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. But no, it's an old game, I'm pretty sure. Probably spacing it. If somebody remembers it, you know, send me some email. But one of the things I was going to say that I also find interesting is, you know, we're talking about the current virtualization and all these different systems, but one of the things we're forgetting about is that Microsoft went and bought Virtual PC, and before the Intel Macs, that was how you ran Windows under a Mac.
Yeah, that was painful.
Yep.
It ran, but not very quickly.
Exactly.
It was a good. It was a good way to say, I have to make sure that the director piece that I just finished will actually run without having to
at half speed.
just wanted to see if it actually worked.
Yep, exactly. So, well, and with that, you know, now Microsoft, I mean, they bought them basically.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, part of Microsoft Office back in the previous generation. It's interesting now with all the virtualization companies coming out. I mean, they're huge in comparison to what the virtual PC product was.
Oh no, it's amazing how quickly it's changed.
Yep.
I mean, yeah. Basically virtual PC when it was expensive, it was like $350.
Yeah. And usually you had to buy it with a copy of Windows.
Well, that was the only way it would get sold. It came with Windows. Like they weren't, to Microsoft's credit, they weren't going to let that product ship without coming with a an actual copy of Windows.
Yep. Yep. Oh, well.
I think that's it. I think we got it all, DOS. You know, being a friend of mine runs Solaris on his Mac Mini.
Mm-hmm.
On his
the primary OS or
no on as emulated.
Okay.
And he's you know, he tells the story that it's the coolest thing, you know, because it's just right there.
Yeah.
And the whole thing runs with what he's doing. Open Solaris is the new, I guess, what all the kids are running these days.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I have one last thing to say about this, and that is, you actually, if you're gonna emulate this, you know, run the emulation and all, you have to be legal on your OS, and that means you can take the number from the retired PC that you have, or you can go buy an OEM copy and make that go,
or get one if you're interested in the Linuxy type stuff or the Unixy stuff. All of that stuff is free. All those distributions, but for Windows, for sure, get yourself a legit copy.
Have you seen GOS?
Mm-mm.
It's the stripped down version of Ubuntu that's been prettied up for being multimedia oriented.
Oh.
So it's got a music player and a browser and an email and a video player all as its primary apps.
Interesting.
And wow. It's a really pretty. It's really pretty, and it's doesn't weigh a lot.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of space, I think it fits on less than a CD, and it's not Linux looking at all.
Hmm. That's a feature for this stuff. It shouldn't look like bare metal.
No,
and they're moving that way.
Yeah, I mean the whole idea that with what Windows, Microsoft, and Apple have done to make the user experience really good. The Linux guys still have a long way to go.
It's tough because it's one of the hardest things to get right, and it's not if your orientation is making stuff work, it always feels like, oh, now I got to make it pretty.
Yeah.
And if design isn't one of your primary considerations, or UI design specifically, if it's just making the thing work under the hood is what you're excited about, and it's no surprise that some of the UI stuff is coming along more slowly on the Linux side.
Well, and just installing an app where you download the app and then you compile the app and then you run make and then you run make install and then hopefully it will work.
Yeah. Package managers are making that stuff easier than it used to be for sure.
Sure.
And most of the time you're using Yum or UpToDate or whatever or I forget the third one.
Apt.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah. Yum is pretty, I'm impressed.
Oh yeah. I mean, nobody wants to work out the dependencies between couple hundred packages manually. It's a recipe for some head bashing.
When I was playing with the open phone system called Asterisk last year, Yum was part of the package, and it really solved so many problems.
Mm-hmm.
Not having to deal with getting that box to the state that it needed to be.
Right.
It just dealt with it. It just did it on its own.
That'd be a fun show to do at some point and talk about Asterisk.
It's
tied into everything under the sun now, too.
Oh, my gosh. It is incredible, that thing. And, it's really geeky. It's really not ready for prime time because somebody has to take care of it.
Right.
You know, you really have to have a dedicated person to knowing how that system works.
Well, some of the tie-ins are taking care of some of like what made me think of it recently? Oh, the Drupal guys. So the Drupal guys do the Lullabot folks specifically are folks who work on Drupal a lot, which is a CMS for that's run up for a lot of sites. And they do a podcast. They were talking to the creator of Asterisk or somebody who manages something around Asterisk about Drupal tie-ins. So you can use Drupal as a front end for all the messaging stuff, the voicemail type of aspects of Asterisk. But yeah, it's worth checking out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, well, the whole problem with the the biggest problem is that if it crashes, which it's not supposed to, but if it does, then the phone doesn't work until it's booted again.
Reboot the phone.
Reboot the phone. Or if you have to do any work on it at all, where you basically have to take the phone down for anything. And but it's rad because you can route all these calls through different systems. Like you can have it come over the plain old telephone or it could go out to Skype.
Right.
Or there was a not Skype Gizmo, Project Gizmo.
What's Gizmo? No.
Gizmo is a competitor to Skype, and I actually like it better. Mm. It's for so many reasons, but it just hasn't got the same traction that Skype did.
Right.
But instead of, from the Asterisk point of view, well, we're way off topic.
Yeah.
From the Asterisk point of view, to hook up Gizmo was like four things in the plan file or the setup file. And Gizmo was like a hack, and it took a day to get working, and it just never, cause they don't have an open version.
Right.
It just wasn't something that the Skype kids were interested in having work.
Here's the emulation tie-in.
Yeah.
You could run an Asterisk server on an emulated box that you're running under Parallels.
Yeah.
There you go. There's our tie-in.
Oh, yeah. You can actually try that out. So you could run Asterisk on your machine. Make that work.
Well, I have one last challenge for people.
What's that?
Because this is the one thing that I've not been able to find emulation for, and it's just because I worked with them. I was, worked for the company, did work on these OSs is IRIX, SGI IRIX emulation on the Mac.
Mm.
Why won't that run? Oh, yeah, no, I know why. I'm sorry. Different processors.
I was going to say proprietary hardware.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
The R9000, the processor, or whatever it was.
It's a MIPS processor. And as far as I know, there's no good way of doing this. So unless you've got an old SGI, you still can't run IRIX in emulation mode.
Wow. Well, I guess you got to keep your O2 around, huh?
Yep, pretty much. I've got that toaster in the closet and a purple high impact in there, too.
You know, if there was ever a machine that I lusted after, it was that O2. It was gorgeous, the way that it looked. I really wanted one because of the way it looked.
The old company I worked for just gave away, well, they actually, I think, took them to the dump, two SGI Onyx 2 systems, like a bunch of O2 toaster boxes, a bunch of them just like no one wanted, you know, take it to the e-landfill.
I don't know if this is any indication of how well that's coming along, Kenji, but the top hit for IRIX emulation says IRIX emulation, getting there, dated Thursday, 4th of September, 1997. So they're close, I think. Yeah.
They've been working on it for 10 years.
No, I'm sure somebody's closer than that, but undercover. It's nice that that's the top hit.
Well, maybe one day I can run that old IRIX software I actually created and put together. Oh, well.
Cool. Well, if you want to have all your stuff on one machine instead of three, check out all the simulation stuff. We will have links to the gob of the things that we've talked about on MacBreakTech.com. I want to thank everybody for listening to the whole network show, the Troubleshooting Craig's Network. We had over 150 people write in for a plastic dinosaur. And so because of that, I was kind of blown away. I found a place to get a whole bunch of dinosaurs for cheap. Nice. So everybody who wrote in gets a dinosaur.
You get one and you get one.
And so the international folks get a flat one because it'll be easier. It'll be shipping or postage-wise, it'll be easier. But the rest of the world
one.
No, it's really cool. You basically take the dinosaur and you poke the parts out and they jam it together.
Collapse?
Oh, the assemblable ones, little cards.
Yeah,
very cool.
Which I think is the cooler dinosaur than the other ones. But you know, I'm not.
You don't want to offend our domestic listeners.
I know. I'm just saying.
Just stating an opinion.
But the other ones are cool too. I mean, the way that they paint these things, like, everyone's going to be impressed.
Cool.
Yeah.
So
very cool.
All right. Well, we didn't have a sponsor this time. That's over. So
we'll be back.
We'll be back. Yeah.
Well, send us your questions, though. You know,
yes.
We always like good questions.
We like the questions. Send us questions. Show ideas. Mm-hmm. The listeners have been really good about saying, hey, you know, I want to hear about this.
Do we have a delicious tag for show ideas for the show yet?
It's MBT ideas.
Great.
Yeah.
Any? It's just all strung together. MBT ideas.
MBT ideas, and I shove stuff there. So on delicious, go and tag things that you will have interest in having us talk about. MBT ideas. MacBreakTech.com is our home of homes. There's another thing on Pixel Core TV, but it seems that the comment traffic is on MacBreakTech.com. Better way to go. Also, if you listen to us on iTunes and you like the show a lot, be sure to write about it and say that that's there. And also, be sure to tell a friend who might want to learn more about Macs in a really fun way that this is the show that they can listen to. So I don't have anything else to talk about. Dinosaurs, emulation, MAME, games. Wine. We didn't talk about wine so much, but that's what crossover is.
Yeah. Yeah, no one. No one really calls it wine anymore, do they?
Well, the wine stuff. I mean, there's a whole bunch of reasons to run wine, but the crossovers guys have done an outstanding job of commercializing the port so that it's way easier to use. You should just throw them $60 instead, I think. Because it's not that much money, you know. $60 is a night out for some people. You know, dinner, a movie, parking, popcorn.
Yep. Support the emulation companies.
Exactly. All right. I have nothing else to say. Do you, Ben?
Nothing.
do Kenji?
Nope.
What was that?
That was me accidentally rubbing the microphone against a zipper.
I don't want to know.
Oh, but don't, oh, this is another show. Never mind.
Exactly. All right. Well, thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you on the other side.